Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books Network. This is the New Books and Literary Studies channel. My name is Dan Moran, and I'm thrilled to be here today with Anatoly Lieberman, author of over 20 books on language, and most recently, take my word for it, A Dictionary of English Idioms, to be published in January 2023 by the University of Minnesota Press. Welcome, Anatoly.
Welcome to you, and thank you very much for contacting me.
Sure. So before we talk about the book, I want to get a little into your fascinating job description. So you work at the University of Minnesota as a professor of Germanic philology. So please tell everybody out there.
That's not entirely true. I'm in the Department of German. That is where I began my work.
Okay.
Then it was the Scandinavian department was added to it. The name was getting longer and longer, and the department smaller and smaller. So as a result, I'm a professor in the department of German, Scandinavian, Nordic, Dutch, Slavic and Dutch. And philology was indeed why I was hired so many years ago. But I would rather say that I'm now a professor of linguistics and the Middle Ages.
Okay. So what are some of your, before we get into the book, you know, what are some of your enthusiasms? What are the things that get you interested? What are things that a philologist or a linguist studies?
Well, philology is a very broad term, and it means both a language and literature, because the word was coined, I think, more or less, probably in our sense of the word, probably by mid-19th century Germans. And where there was no distinction between linguistics and literature, because there was practically no linguistics. Everything was one branch. Today, these are different areas. One thing is linguistics, one thing is literature, and I'm in both. So when I say philology, it's really medieval philology, Germanic philology, so history of language and history of literature.
Okay, great. So let's move on to your newest book. Let's move on to Take My Word for It. So tell everybody out there listening, you know, what is an idiom?
I'm afraid there is no way I can define it to everybody's satisfaction. But the simplest definition, and the simplest definition is never very good, is that if you have more than one word, and this combination is important because it produces or yields a meaning of its own, then it's an idiom. And there are many such words. Sometimes it's almost one word. For example, you know what give means and you know what up means, but that won't help you at all in guessing what to give up means. And that's, of course, the horror that all foreigners know. Even something much simpler like stand up to or for something, and you aren't supposed to stand up. And when you stand down, you're not supposed to stand down. And then there are phrases which we use almost automatically, sight unseen. That's an idiom. And there, or something very long, raining cats and dogs, or whatever. So let's say that if there are more than one word, and in order to understand the meaning of this combination, you have to learn the meaning, the sense, or look it up if you happen to be a miserable foreigner, that's an idiom.
Yeah. So the whole of the idiom's meaning is greater than the sum of its parts, because the individual definitions won't help you.
It's even contradictory sometimes, because when you give something up, you don't give anything and you don't go up anywhere.
Right.
You rather go down.
Well, to use another idiom, let's dive in to your book here. So you open the book with a preface, and I want to quote you from this. You say that this book is, quote, better than a thriller and better than a novel because you can open it at any page, go forward or backward, and find oneself neck deep in never-ending intrigue. Now, I love that. Now, I know you're being humorous there, but there's something to this, because later in your introduction, you talk about the intrigue and the allure of tracking down the sources of idioms, right? So what's it like to chase the history of a single idiom? Like, you have these phrases like go the whole hog or monkey on the chimney. What's that detective work like?
It's not absolutely different from studying or from learning the etymology of a separate word. For example, you want to know the etymology of the word hog. All the same, you will have to do a lot of work, of exploration. But in order to find out the origin of a word, you need something that I usually call linguistic algebra, because words are connected according to certain, very often, recondite rules, and you have to learn a lot. You have to learn a lot of languages. If you study English, you have to know German, you have to know Scandinavian, and very often it will be Latin and Greek and Sanskrit. You have to find some root. Whereas idioms, of course, are from this point of view much easier. And that's why this book can be a thriller to the non-initiated, because you don't have to know anything about the history of the word hog or hole in order to guess the meaning. But they're as obscure as separate words. You don't know the origin of the word hog. How do you go about it? Well, you have to take many university courses, many college courses, and then you will be able to learn it or not, because at the end of your way, of a long road, you may be told that the origin is still unknown. There are thousands of words which have been investigated very well, and we still don't know how they were coined. And it's the same thing with idioms. Sometimes we don't know anything about the origin. That is, it's very hard to explain why give up means to give up. And I'm not sure that I have ever read anything about it, because these things are taken for granted. But when there is an idiom which seems to have a double bottom, go the whole hog. Well, apparently it's something to do with hogs, apparently. And apparently with not with one segment of this hog, but with the whole hog. And how do you go the whole hog? And where do you go the whole hog? And so on. So that is how you begin to look for the origin. You first of all, you try to find out when the idiom was coined. Because when the idiom was coined, it was probably, even certainly, transparent to those who coined it. They knew why they said so, but then they disappeared, and we don't. And someone knew who said raining cats and dogs. It was not so mysterious at that time. It was probably not mysterious at all. So you are left more or less with the same as a word. You have the word put, get, kick, get, dog, cat, and who coined these words? So you try to find the source of an idiom. Who coined it? When? Which is very important. Under what circumstances? How were those idioms understood? But it's a very difficult process, because all words and all idioms and all innovations go the same, follow the same road, the same way. Somebody says something funny. Let's say go the whole hog, since you cited it. And everybody laughs because they know what it means. Then the children already know the meaning, but don't know why their parents used it. And then nobody knows it. And they begin to guess. And this guesswork is sometimes profitable and sometimes not. So in order to find out the origin of an idiom, you have to try to find the early stages and the many opinions, because somebody in the hog industry, for example, may know it, or may not know it, or may think that he or she knows it, but is great and is taken. People very often think, oh, yes, well, that's easy to explain. No, 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 that is an illusion. So you try to do the explanatory work that more or less the way detectives do. That's why it's a thriller. You try to find out. Very often it's simply very many opinions, a matter of very many opinions. Some people think so, others people so. And then somebody may sometimes guess cleverly, and then it's not really that they prove something, but it seems reasonable. And that's usually as far as you go. So that is what it means. Oh, that hog. Uh-huh. And that's why you go the whole hog. Oh, so it's, oh, it's some from some sort of hockey game. So there was, were really no hogs, right. And so on. So that's how you do it. Sometimes you find the beginning, and sometimes you don't. Exactly as you are, as with separate words.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's funny because you just, I love the story of you just said about at some point, everybody's in on the joke and everybody understands the joke and laughs. But one thing your book made me do is it made me realize how even a phrase that's not mysterious anymore, like raining cats and dogs, you said, we don't even think that's odd anymore. People just say it without thinking about how strange it is. But your book, when you become an idiom detective, you start to notice just how strange these phrases are, like whole hog or raining cats and dogs.
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. And that's why it is a thriller, because after all, at the end of the thriller, you know the denouement. You know who done it. Right. You know who killed whom. Even if it is a very good story, you will finally find out. And here you have a riddle with multiple solutions, and you can go on. You are part of the thriller and not only a consumer.
Yeah, because every time you speak one of these idioms, you're involved in the mystery.
That's exactly true. And so then there is, of course, that element of fun. Everybody loves idioms because with the moment you begin to say something like that, people begin to smile. A student is sitting in front of me, and I see that the student is thinking of something else. And I say, Tom, I think you've gone wool gathering. And everybody begins to laugh. It's a good thing to say. And I said, do you know why we say to go wool gathering? Do you know what it means? Sometimes yes, sometimes no, as the case may be. Yes, no, I have no idea, but I know what it means, or I've never heard it. Well, then open my book, so to speak. Of course, that's not what I'll say to you. And you will find out whether there was any wool gathering there. And the story begins to unravel.
Yeah, the book, and it's so funny because if somebody said, I'm going to read the newest book by a professor of philology and linguistics, that stuff can be very, very heavy. But your book has a very light touch. You are clearly having fun writing this book.
I think that every good teacher turns his or her subject into a source of fun.
Yes,
not fun in the vulgar meaning that everybody will now begin to giggle. But because you see the beauty of investigation.
Yes, yes.
The beauty of the process. That's the like solving an equation, right. Like finding the answer to a good mathematical problem. That's the fun. And not simply if I tickle you, we'll begin to giggle. That's not fun.
Right. Yeah, it's a great intellectual, fun
it's an
game.
Adventure.
It's an adventure, exactly. It's an adventure. So I want to ask you about something else you said in your introduction, which really struck me. This really, really struck me when I read it. It's that this idea that English idioms are from a post-medieval culture. And you say that at the dawn of the Renaissance, so we're talking about, the early modern period, that English painters and speakers gained perspective and what you call signs of abstract thinking, and that idioms are one such sign of a new way to see the world and a new way to describe other people. Can you talk about that shift in perspective and language?
We don't have a whole day for that. So I'll try to be not too long about it. But the problem is that the post-Renaissance period, when I say the post-Renaissance, let us say, if you begin with Italy, after Raphael and Leonardo, so the 15th century, with Shakespeare, it's a little bit later. Mm-hmm. And since we're in English, let us more or less begin with the with Elizabethans. So Shakespeare died in 616. So let us begin with the 16th century or so. And this is when people learned a lot of things. I won't tell you why they learned them and how, because that's a very long story. But they invented many things. They stopped being part of a picture. That's when they when they discovered the existence of perspective. Anyone who has seen children's drawings will know that they're beautiful things, but they're flat. And the same is true of medieval pictures. They're beautiful pictures, beautiful illustrations of saints' lives and so on, but they're flat. They're exactly like children's pictures because the artist is part of the canvas. The ability of jumping out of the canvas and looking at everything from some distance, that is the greatest difference between what may be called medieval and post-medieval intelligence and or mentality. And at that time, they began to use idioms. That is, they invented the beauty of a metaphor. Medieval poets used wonderful similes and epithets. They could say, I think I even quote this, my beloved is a rose.
Right.
But my beloved is like a rose.
But
they would never say my beloved is a rose. It seems such a very obvious thing to say, but that's how it is. Perspective. They were no longer tied to the direct meaning of what they said. That's why there are no idioms. Because if you say it's raining cats and dogs, you look up and look for cats and dogs. You had to step out of this to get perspective, something that you may call literary perspective or linguistic perspective. When you can say to someone, you are not in a hurry to kick the bucket, and no bucket anywhere around, and no one is expected to kick the bucket. But that's a very important step away from the canvas. You are an observer and not only the master. There are early idioms, but they're either quotes from the Bible or translations from Latin or Greek, but they're not genuine English idioms. But all those cats and dogs are post-medieval.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a fascinating moment in the history of the language.
Indeed.
So let's talk. You also tell a story about how you once tried to find the origin of the word heifer and how that fueled you over time to begin this project, right? So can you talk about the connection between, you know, that cow and this book?
Well, that will take me a few seconds, because otherwise I would have kept you here sitting for hours.
That's okay.
One day I saw the word heifer, English word heifer, and wondered what the origin of the word is, and of course looked it up, and the answer was absolutely satisfactory: origin unknown. So this was quite a shock to me, and I looked it up in another dictionary, and found that some people had some ideas. So I decided that I should find out what the origin of the word heifer is. But in order to find out what the origin of the word heifer is, I had to know what was written about this word. And that means looking up in dictionaries. The number of dictionaries is limited. I looked it up in 5 or 6 dictionaries, and that was it. Then I, by chance, ran into an article about this word. And it irritated me that I had never heard about this article. And that article had references to other articles. And I thought, how is it possible that there is no place in the world where you can look up the word heifer and find the literature on heifer? Because you can do it if you are studying, if you study German or French or any Slavic language. There are dictionaries with the bibliography where you can find anything, but you look up even the great OED, which is after all not an etymological dictionary, but you look it up in Skeet. Skeet is the main etymological dictionary of English still, though it is more than 100 years old. There are no references. You know what Skeet thought about the word, and that's where you are. So I decided that I should save the world and produce such a bibliography. And that was about, I think, 25 years ago. And I began to do it. And the project engulfed me, absolutely. Volunteers and paid assistance. And the odyssey about how I got the financial support, about those who helped me. So as now, at the beginning of the 20th century, the University of Minnesota Press published my voluminous bibliography of English etymology. You want to know the origin of any English word? Look up. And all the articles are in my office, but all the references are in my book. And while studying the history of words, I naturally encountered many idioms. And I thought that should wait, because I cannot do both things. And now I know that I will never write the entire dictionary. I need another 30, 40, or 50 years for that, which I obviously do not have. But I have published an introduction together with my friend and colleague. So there is a good idea. You can get a good idea of how it was done. But then I decided, it was about 10 years ago, I'll probably never write the entire dictionary unless I read until I'm 1,000 years old. But I can do the same with idioms. And we collected idioms. And I knew that it was a project which you could begin and finish, more or less. And that's how from the heifer to cats and dogs, that's the way.
That's great. Again, more detective work. I love all the detective work.
Oh, it's all detective work.
Yeah.
It's all detective work.
That's good. So I want to ask you about, it's funny you're talking about dictionaries. So one of my personal heroes is Samuel Johnson, the great lexicographer who wrote his English dictionary, came out in 1755. And you probably know this. I'm sure you know this. His famous joke definition of lexicographer was, in part, it was a harmless drudge. A harmless drudge.
You cannot imagine how often this joke has been repeated.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Everybody knows it, and every lexicographer knows it, and everybody
knows it. Yes, it's part of your. Yes.
And it's half true and half untrue. It's true in the sense that if you want to do something, it's not necessarily etymology. Samuel Johnson was not a specialist in etymology. Right. He copied his etymologies from other sources. They were tremendously outdated. And today they are using the polite parlance of scholarship only of historical interest, which means they're not interesting at all. Right. Well, of course.
Yeah, they're interesting to Johnson fans. Yeah.
It's a euphemism.
Yes.
But if you want to do that hard work, then yes, you are a drudge. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt about it. But when you come to the end of the process, especially in etymology, you're a detective. But before you become a detective, you have to do all the dirty work. So it's not drudgery, but it is harmless. That's true.
That's good.
Well, it's stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, you obviously have a sense of humor. I said earlier that your book has a sense of humor, and you could see that in the epigraph you've chosen for take my word for
it. I love epigraphs too.
And so, I just want to give the listener a sense of yours. So you quote an anonymous review from Notes and Queries of a book called Significant Etymology, in which the reviewer says this, quote, "Nothing is easier than to turn out a popular book on etymologies." So can you talk about that choice of epigraph?
That's absolute nonsense, of course. it may be easy if all you want to do is to copy from somebody else. Right. Then yes, But if you want to produce at least a modicum of novelty in your dictionary, then nothing is more difficult than doing that. Of course, if you are simply copying, that's easy. And that's, of course, what many people have done. Mm-hmm. You read it in this dictionary, you read it in that dictionary, you put them together, and then you pretend that you have an opinion. Actually, you have no opinion. You have simply used other people's words and other people's wisdom, quote unquote. But if it is an original work, no original work is easy. But that epigraph is damning because the author did everything wrong. There was no accuracy in the book. There was no originality. That is, in all everything that he claimed, he failed miserably.
And that's right there as the epigraph for your book, which I think is great.
Yes, ironically, if somebody wants to tear me to pieces, fine. I'm prepared.
You've already told them how to do it. You've already told them what to say.
Yeah, of course. Of course, we have known it all along.
Okay, let's move into the book and the actual idioms. How many of them are there in your book?
About over 1,000.
Over 1,000. Okay, great.
Over 1,000. And it's a very important question because every lexicographer has to answer the question, where do I stop?
Yes.
And there are small dictionaries for children. There are collegiate Webster's for anyone. Then there is the OED, which is Oxford English Dictionary, mm-hmm. and which pretends to have all the words in the world. And there is Big Webster's Dictionary, where you practically find everything you need. But again, it's not everything. The same with idioms. There are countless idioms. And in while preparing for our talk, quite by chance, it's always by chance, of course, but this chance come, you find the chance only if you're prepared for them. There was a folklorist called Thomas Radcliffe, and this is a quote from him, which I liked very much. The old gossips, of course, means old women in 19th century and 18th century English. The old gossips still use hundreds of unrecorded sayings, which is true. Right. And I had to choose something. I also, my database, which is, I think you pronounce database, but I still use my old-fashioned pronunciation database. My database is much larger than what I have in the book, because I didn't want to go on and on and on, and not to be, and didn't want to be too repetitive. And then I wanted some idioms about which I could say something, though I did not exclude some of the idioms about which I could say nothing. In my index, I even have a line, idioms which have never been explained, so that one could go on and pick up where I have left off. But my material was limited because I wanted to find only those idioms about which people have tried to say something. And if there was no discussion, then there is no idiom in the book. It doesn't pretend to exhaust the subject, and no one can exhaust it. There are dozens and dozens of old and new dictionaries of idioms. It's especially easy to do if you deal with proverbs. Proverbs are countless, and even the first dictionaries of proverbs were much larger than what we have today. And I excluded almost all proverbs because that's what everybody can find in other books. And I was limited by my sources, that is the journals which I have explored.
Yeah, can we talk about some of those? Let's talk about those. What were some of you have all your sources after each entry, right? But what were some of the sources that you found very, very fruitful?
So-called popular press. That is something which is almost dead today. Because there are professional journals, and if you want a linguistic question to answer, then you look it up in a linguistic source. But not too long ago, when both of us actually were boys, even you and not only I'm considerably older than you are, but that's the same thing. You could find good answers about such things in Scientific American, for example, in Times. That is, in so-called popular journals, in periodicals, in Atlantic Monthly, for example, for a long time, there was a section there. All that is, I think, either totally or almost totally dead. Today, you can find such things only in professional journals and not too much of this stuff. But beginning with the end of the 17th century, more in the 18th, and especially in the 19th, these popular periodicals or journals, call them whatever you like, they brimmed with questions and answers. And some of the answers, as always, were wrong. Some of them were very clever. And nobody has ever collected those answers. Though one of the latest Dictionary of Idioms does refer to Notes and Queries. Notes and Queries is one of the wonders of the world.
Yes, I remember reading Notes and Queries as an undergraduate, so I remember I remember Notes and Queries. Sure,
it's an absolute. Now it's all online.
Yes,
but it's an absolutely wonderful journal, rather than, say, periodical, and everything you want to know some genealogical information about so and so, write a letter to Notes and Queries. 2 weeks later, you will get an answer.
Someone will answer you, yes.
Somebody will know. Somebody will know. You have found a coin, and you cannot decipher the inscription. Write a letter to Notes and Queries. A week later, 2 weeks later, somebody will say, yes, yes, I know the coin, and that's what it is. And as to the language, blah, 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 blah. And among those questions, one finds hundreds, actually thousands, of questions about word origins and the origins of idioms. The clientele was mixed. Some of those people were professional, that is linguists, but 98% of them were not linguists. And they were amazingly well-educated. We cannot imagine how well-educated they are. Today, with our students knowing a million times less than those people, we cannot even imagine how clever those people were. That's why there is an index at the end of my book explaining references to all the books, history books, novels, and so on, about which none of us knows anything. Those were very well-educated people. They went to school. They had 6 or 7 years of Latin, 2 or 3 years of Greek, all beaten into them very well. And they usually knew some foreign language, French, as a rule. And their opinions were sometimes wrong, but they were seldom stupid. Stupid opinions appear there too. So it was very, very interesting to see what people could say about the origin of idioms. Something that there are people who know the value of these journals, and there is in the bibliography for notes and queries, but no one has used this bibliography. You have a list, and we opened every page and copied every page, and I read every page and summarized everything that has been said there. And sometimes it's great fun, really, especially with cats and dogs, a lot of nonsense, absolute nonsense. And then suddenly, at the end of the process, I ran into an answer which struck me as an absolutely correct explanation. Whether it is correct or not, I don't know. The same was with pay through the nose. All kinds of references, all kinds of explanations, which I knew right away were wrong. And then suddenly, something which struck me as really correct. Now, whether it is correct or not, nobody knows. But it's the best of all the answers, and it makes sense. So that's why I thought it was very good. Probably the best, in addition to cats and dogs, which is really the greatest jewel in my crown, there is one which is equally good, and that is for which there are countless answers, by hook or by crook. It's unimaginable what nonsense people said about Mr. Hook and Mr. Crook, and so on. You know, those legendary gentlemen never existed, but everybody was sure that they had existed. And I think finally, I ran into an explanation. You know, there is that quality which characterizes truth. When you see something which is true, you suddenly feel, yes, that's the way it is.
That's your detective's hunch.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. So that even if it's wrong, it can be absolutely wrong. That's a correct approach. And that's what I felt. I must say that in general, etymology is a very hard subject. It's very hard. The best scholars do not agree about the origin of the simplest words, God, for example, and earth, and so on. But usually, the simplest explanations are the best. The more complicated an explanation, the more suspicious it is. The truth somehow always turns out to be simple.
Well, that's true in detective novels, of course, as well.
Oh, is that of course.
The most baroque,
I should have guessed it myself.
Right, exactly. Well, let's talk. I cannot resist asking you about let's talk about Cats and Dogs or Hook It by Crook or Peg It Through the Nose. Can you tell us the origins of one of those three phrases? Any one you choose.
It's not a very short explanation. It seems that Peg It Through the Nose comes from what happens on board a ship. So pay means something like pull, and it's the nose of the ship. That is, it's a metaphor which was absolutely clear to seafaring people.
Sure.
And of course, when you think about your own nose, then everything is lost. Cats and Dogs seems to go back to a metaphor from sports. The whole hog also from sports. That's the trouble with them, that when you're raining cats and dogs, you think that you are dealing with real cats and real dogs. And it may be that there is a step away. Yes, there are cats and dogs, but not those quadrupeds which you want to discuss. And you pay through the nose. Yes, the nose. But not the nose, which is plain on your face, but somebody else's nose, and you don't really pay with hard cash. It's something else, and that's the trouble of such.
Yeah.
Same with Hook and Crook. No gentleman, as I said, called Mr. Hook and Mr. Crook, and it's probably a metaphor from forestry, from medieval forestry, and that makes sense. It may be wrong. One never, within etymology, one never knows the so-called absolute truth. There may be someone who knows a better explanation, but at least with a dictionary like mine, and of course I am only the last of many people who have tried to do this thing, with this work, you at least can ignore nonsense, which is a very important step in etymology. Forget a lot of nonsense that has been said. That narrows down your vision, and which is very good. So you know more or less where, again, as I say, like in a detective story, with what Poirot did in Agatha Christie's books. No, that's improbable. And that's improbable. Let's try this. Let's try that. And then finally, you narrow it down the circle of murderers, and the murderer emerges, only that in my work, the murderer is still only a suspect. But that's as much as you can expect.
You can get a better suspect. That's right. You have to eliminate all the red herrings, like Mr. Crook and Mr. Hook are red herrings. They seem reasonable, but they don't exist.
Absolutely. And why you draw a red herring across the path is also a very interesting
It's also.
I didn't include it because the origin is known very well.
Yes.
It's known exactly where it came from. And somehow, for some reason, it has never been discussed in my sources.
All right. Well, let's, you know, as I went through your highly, highly addictive book, you know, I found many idioms that I've never heard before. So we're mentioning all these famous ones, but I heard ones, I mean, I could almost open up at random. I heard ones like side pocket to a toad for something useless. To have a soul above buttons is, to be very honest, I think that was great. And the one, the tune the old cow died of. as a way to describe an ill-played piece of music. I thought these were great. So can you talk about some of the oddest idioms that you discovered and how to do some detective work on for this
book? Well, let me quote what's right. The old gossips still use hundreds of unrecorded things. Yeah, right. That's exactly where we are. I've heard more or less the same thing from my colleagues, just what you said. Nobody knows all these idioms, just as nobody knows all the words in Webster's dictionary, and you're not supposed to. Some of the idioms are local. They're British in most cases, but they're rather international too. Some of the most obscure idioms may have come from India. That's the cheese, for example.
Oh, really?
Because, yes, that's the Anglo-Indian jargon, where cheese, in Urdu, I think, it means thing. So that's the cheese was a joke, meaning that's the thing. And then the people began to guess what kind of cheese it was. There is a wonderful idiom there, fox's wedding. That means, that is what they say when there is rain and sunshine at the same time. There is a whole book tracing the history of this expression. Why fox? Why wedding? It also seemed to have started in India. You may never have heard about Fox's wedding. Neither had I before I began working on this dictionary. And many of these idioms remain local. Also, some of my sources are old. Those idioms perhaps were known in, let us say, 1850 or 1860, and now no longer known even in that county. So despite the British predominance of the British element, most of the best idioms are still international. Also, the English, that is the colonists, came to the United States just at the time of the Renaissance. Shakespeare died in 1616. So we're a few years after the Pilgrim. And they brought their idioms to the United States. What is called an Americanism. So sometimes it is an Americanism, a blue plate dinner, because it's something that started in the United States. But many of those idioms are probably American, but have never been recorded in Britain. So they are not really American. They emerged in American English, but they are probably British. So even though there is such a strong British element in this book, it's really a book that can be called international. Then there are so many which owe something to French idioms. That is British when you look at them, but really international.
Okay, that's fascinating. Oh, let me up the ante, to use another idiom. My last big question for you is this: is that, you know, I had so much fun, and I still have fun going through this book, and it's so addictive. Like I said, it's like a great thriller. But what are some of the big conclusions that a reader of this book can make about language and about how language, you know, operates from a book as playful as this? What are some of the big takeaways about how language works?
Well, I think that if someone nobody will probably read the book the way you have from beginning to end, and nobody is expected to do so. Though I think that the material is so interesting that if someone opens the book, it's almost it will work almost by its own attraction, so to speak. I have read this interesting idiom. And what's the next one? Because when you read simply words, you probably don't want to know all the words beginning with the letter B or with the letter F. But here, that's how it is. What is the next one? I think there is some attraction in the material. I, of course, don't expect anyone to read the book from beginning to end, but I think that those who will read enough will learn something about the playful element of language. They will find out how many people are interested in what they are interested, so that they are not exceptions, but they are in good company. And I think the reading is addictive in a certain way. You begin to read it, you want more and more. You see how language operates. You see how rich our resources are, how little we know about them in comparison to what really exists, I think it's a good educational tool, and I think it's a good cultural envoy to the world.
Yeah. That's a great way to describe it. Yeah, it gives you a great sense of it gives you how little we know about things we take for granted every day.
That's absolutely so. It seems that, you know, how often, you probably don't know very often, children are asked that is who are 7, 8, or 9 years old. How many words do you think you know? I know all the words. Of course. I've heard this. I've played this game many times. And the answer is absolutely natural. Are there any words I don't know? Yes.
Yeah. There's a few.
You're still left.
Well, it was great talking to you today. Do you have any other projects you want to get to next, or anything that's grabbed your enthusiasm now?
I don't know. My projects always engender other projects.
Uh-huh.
I'll of course go on with words, collecting an update bibliography. After all, it appeared almost 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's always extremely interesting to see what has been written since the year 2000. So I'll keep writing about these things. And I have been commissioned to write several papers for all kinds of editions. And I'm going to develop some of them. There is still enough work for me to do. And I hope to be able to do at least some of it before I say goodbye to my profession.
Okay. Well, I wish you all the best in that, because I urge everybody to get a copy of Take My Word For It. The author is Anatoly Lieberman. It's a fascinating read. It's also, you could tell by our conversation, so much fun. Anatoly, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It has really been a source of enjoyment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.